Well, thank you very much for the. Is it working? No. Oh, now it is. Okay. Thanks for the invitation. I guess many years ago I said I wouldn't apologize for the kind of math that I'm doing, but I'm really out of place here, so I'm changing my story. I mostly work in complex analytic geometry, and I'm a consumer of stuff you wouldn't probably even call operator theory, but well, I was invited, so. Okay, so let me discuss this setting. So we start in CN, that's our ambient space, and inside this ambient space, we have a complex hypersurface, which in CN just means that. So there exists some holomorphic function with no particular properties. So this O is the holomorphic functions in CN, with W being given as the zero set of T, but also generated as the ideal. So DT restricted to W is not identically zero, but it could be zero, so this W is allowed to be singular in principle. Okay. So that's some of the data. How low can I go here? Okay, I guess I'll just lift this one and I won't use the one underneath. So, okay, so then I have a weight that I'm just going to require from the outset to be plurisubharmonic. If you like n equals 1, that's an important case anyway. So this is, it would be just subharmonic, so Laplacian greater than or equal to 0. So that's my weight. And then I have, I'm going to use the ambient Euclidean metric. I'm going to call the associated 1-1 form omega. So this is just think of it as an area form in CN. Okay, and then I have some Hilbert spaces. Okay. So the first one I'll write as script H of CN phi. It's the set of all holomorphic functions on CN such that the integral, the weighted L2 norm, so here you put omega to the n, this is just the Lebesgue measure, maybe divided by n factorial, this should be finite. Okay. So that's one Hilbert space. Maybe I have room for the second Hilbert space here. I mean, it's essentially the same kind of object. So these would now be holomorphic functions on W. Remember, W is singular. So in the case of CN, at least, a holomorphic function on W is just the restriction of a holomorphic function on all of CN. But for a general singular space, it's locally the restriction from some ambient manifold. Okay, so, right, and then again we have L2 condition. This time we integrate over the non-singular part of W. And the Lebesgue measure on this regular part is just the n minus first power of omega. And the point of this different H is to say that the metric and the weight come from the ambient space. Okay. And then, of course, you have a restriction map. So I'll put a dash arrow. So if you take a holomorphic function that's L2, you may try to restrict it to W and ask if that is L2, and it might not be. But even if it is, what else could you ask about this restriction operator? You could ask if it's surjective or injective. So if it's injective, what that means is that the values of the function on W completely determine its values on the ambient space. which is called so you say that W is sampling. And if it's surjective, it means that you can extend any L2 data from W to the ambient space with still having finite L2 norm. Okay? So I'm the case of when this is a bounded operator, it's not so hard to understand. It's also not that interesting. So I'm going to completely leave it out. The condition is long to state, but it's not that hard to understand. So I'm going to completely omit the sampling, the injectivity problem, because at least from the point of view of applications, it's much more natural to sample on points than on hypersurfaces. And this kind of shows itself in the types of solutions you get. You don't get a very nice answer when you try to see whether or not this restriction operator is injective. So that doesn't mean the story's closed there, but I'm going to focus on when is this map surjective. So the basic question. Under what conditions is RW surjective? Okay. So let me give a little bit of history here. That's me. So it's not necessarily the history of this subject. I'm not sure what the history of the subject is, but I have my own understanding of it, but it's certainly incomplete. So, sorry? Yeah. That's good. Okay, so the first problem that initiated the kind of work I was interested in this setting was a problem in laser physics, which I'm not going to state very precisely, but roughly speaking, the situation was n equals 1, so you had the complex plane, so and then the weight phi was just the square modulus of z, so this is the Fock space, and you wanted to have a lattice of points so that the restriction map was both injective and surjective. That was the hope. And people were trying to find such a sequence, and they were having trouble, and they were getting very close to seeing that maybe it doesn't exist, but didn't quite have it nailed down until the work of Christian Sape showed that there does not exist, in fact, not only a lattice, but he showed that there's no sequence at all such that RW is bijective. So let me be a bit more precise about what he proved. He completely understood when you had the boundedness, surjectivity, and injectivity in this setting. So let me just say quickly, so boundedness was equivalent to saying that W was a finite union of uniformly separated sequences. Okay. So that's not a very hard thing in this case. Certainly he wasn't too worried about that part, but his really amazing theorems are these. So theorem one, let's see, was that RW is surjective if and only if the following two things hold. One, W is uniformly separated. So, of course, what I mean by that is you take the infimum of the distance between any two distinct points in the sequence that's bounded away from zero. Okay. And then two, and okay, so he considered some kind of asymptotic density. I'm going to write it for a general weight, He initially considered the weight mod z squared, and later, with Kim Ortega, generalized to general weights. But I'll write the final result. So the density, this asymptotic density, is obtained as follows. So the first thing you do is you choose a point z in the complex plane, and then you look at a disk of radius r centered at z, and you count the number of points of w inside that sequence. Okay? And now you divide by something like the area of the disk, but the area has to be weighted with respect to some area form coming from this weight. And so that area form, it happens to be this one. I'll write it like this. So maybe I better do this. dd bar phi is a complex Laplacian. And now you take the supremum over all points in C. And then you take the lim sup as r goes to infinity, and this gives you a measure of the asymptotic density of the sequence relative to this weight, and this should be less than 1. Okay, so people knew that for surjectivity, this lattice should have this density less than or equal to 1. And they knew that for injectivity, some analogous thing I'm about to write down should be greater than or equal to 1, but the strict inequality prevents the existence of a bijective. So the other theorem of SAPE is that this RW is injective if and only if W is the union of uniformly separated sequences. Well, I shouldn't quite write it like this. Let me put this in quotes, injective. Okay, yeah. So each of these is uniformly separated. And so that's one. And two. And now you just put inf wherever you see sup. So this quantity is called the lower density, and this should be bigger than 1. Okay. So those are SAPE's theorems. Well, as I said, SAPE, in the case mod z squared, and then with Kim Ortega and some other people, it's for some small parts of it, in the general case. Good. Ah, yes, thank you. So it's not exactly, actually the problem of determining whether or not it's injective is a little more strange. So you want something more stable than injectivity from the applied point of view. So you actually want it to be bounded, okay, so that you're forced into this because of the remark I made up there. But you also want the, so once it's injective, you can look at the inverse defined on the image, and you want that inverse to be bounded as well. And that has a different name. It's called sampling. And it just says that the L2 norm on the ambient space is comparable to the L2 norm on the sequence. So that's what this quote injective means. So maybe I can, well, I'm not going to discuss injectivity any further, so let me just leave it at that. Okay. Maybe there is some other work done in this area. It's not going to be as relevant to my talk, but I should mention it. One thing you can consider, so you can consider W that are not uniformly separated, but you need to change something. And there are a number of things you can change. One of my students, for example, changed the little L2 norm on W. So he did this in dimension 1, and then it turns out that I accidentally didn't know it, but did something about it in higher dimensions, and other people as well. I'll get back to that in a little bit. You can also consider other ambient spaces. So that was also done by Sape. Sape considered the disk, but there's and he used the Poincaré metric on the disk, and the conditions. In fact, the things change a little bit. You don't really count the number of points, but you take logarithmic averages. And, it's not so important for this talk, but it's very interesting. And then people have considered Riemann surfaces, more general Riemann surfaces. But there, the theory is less clean. And there's even been higher dimensional spaces other than CN. But these are a couple things I'm not going to discuss very much. So now let me continue with my history in higher dimensions. In higher dimensions. So I guess I didn't write this in my notes, but I should say, from the applied math point of view, the more natural problem is not to consider a hypersurface, but rather to consider points in CN. Because those are the natural ways to sample the value of functions on a point. It's quite hard to sample a function on the hypersurface. But there are good reasons to consider hypersurfaces, even if you are interested in applied math problems. So there was a little bit of work done on, some nice work done on points, but I'm not going to discuss it here. So I'm going to stick to this case, the hypersurface case. And as far as I know, the first work was by Kim Ortega. I guess his father is also Kim Ortega, so he goes by Ortega Cerda. And Alex Schuster and myself. These are pluses, joint work. So we tried to extend Sape's theorem. At least I'm going to focus on theorem 1 here. We have some theorem 2 results, but so at that time we just considered the sufficiency of these two conditions. So first of all, what are these two conditions? What does it mean to be uniformly separated? Okay, so I'll tell you what that means. Definition. So I guess in our work we just considered W smooth. So W is a smooth hypersurface, so that just means that this DT, the defining function, is never zero. Not just not identically zero, but never zero. Okay. Is said to be uniformly flat. The definition of uniformly flat, if the following. So you take an epsilon neighborhood of W. So this is the set of all points Z in CN, such that the distance from Z to this W, so the nearest point on W, is less than epsilon. So this is a Euclidean epsilon neighborhood, and you want this to be a tubular neighborhood. What does that mean, to be a tubular neighborhood? It means that if you choose, so i.e., so for all z in u epsilon of w, There exists a unique W sub Z in W such that the distance between, so the Euclidean distance between Z and this W sub Z is equal to the distance from Z to W. In other words, if you look at an orthogonal disk protruding from your W, and you look at some other one from coming from some other point, and they meet somewhere, then the distance from the meeting point to W on either disk has to be more than this epsilon. So there has to be some epsilon so that this is so there's a unique disk of radius epsilon orthogonal to W. It doesn't intersect any of the other ones. Does that make sense? So let me draw a couple of pictures of how things could go wrong. So one thing that could go wrong is something like this, like a teardrop shape. Imagine pinching off as you go off to infinity. That's not uniformly flat. But another thing that could happen is very rapid oscillations. So it's still smooth, but the disks that don't meet any other orthogonal disks have to get very, very small. So these are not allowed. So let's think about what happens when W is a hypersurface in C, which is just a sequence of points. Well, then the orthogonal disk is just a disk of radius epsilon centered around each of the points, and you're saying that those disks never meet. So it's a generalization of uniformly separated. Okay. So it's a natural condition. What about the second? This condition's intuitive and it's sort of easy to explain. The second condition, I'll leave the setting up so I can remember. The second condition is that was stupid. That's a little harder to explain. That's the analog of this density. Right. So I'm going to define this upper density of a hypersurface. It's going to look awful. So this will be a Lim soup as R goes to infinity, and it will be a soup over Z in Cn, and then a soup over all unit vectors also in Cn. And then you do the following. Maybe I don't want that actually. Yeah, okay. Okay, so I compute the average integral over a ball of radius r centered at z of the following. Log mod t of zeta squared omega to the n zeta. Oops. And then here I want to multiply by vi vj bar sum over I and j bar going from 1 to n. And then divide this whole thing by the integral. BZR, average integral, maybe R to the, I think it's R squared here, D2 D zeta J of phi VI VJ bar. Again, summation over I J bar. Okay, so you average out this. This is the curvature of this weight. You average it out, but with respect to this pair of vectors. So this looks awful. So maybe I should try to explain what is this thing. And it has a very simple intuitive meaning. So here's your W, okay? And what you want to do is choose a direction. So let's say we choose this direction here, V. Okay. And then we consider a sort of generic parallel line to V. Okay. And now we compute the density of the sequence you get when this line V intersects this hypersurface. And then we average over sort of parallel Vs. Okay. So that's the meaning of this density. And then you want to take the supremum over all possible directions. So the worst, the most dense possible direction that you get. And that's the upper density. And so the theorem we proved was this direction. So theorem, Ortega, Schuster, and myself, if W is uniformly flat and D plus phi W is less than 1, then RW is surjective. So there's also the analogous statement for theorem 2. We also assumed that W was uniformly flat, and then you define with inf here and inf here D minus, and you prove that if W is uniformly flat and D minus is bigger than 1, then the restriction map is injective. But that's not exactly what's written there. There you have a sequence that's a union of uniformly flat sequences. And how do you extract a subset of a not uniformly flat hypersurface, which is still a smooth hypersurface, or even a singular hypersurface? So that's what I meant before when I said that in the higher dimensional case, the sampling problem is a little more messy looking. It doesn't split as naturally, and then you don't. I really think that you're supposed to look at points for the injectivity problem. Yeah? Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's the omega to the n is the Lebesgue measure. So, yeah, you're right. So maybe I should say that this thing here, before you plug in the Vs, that's the current of integration. This is the Poincaré-Lalong formula says that up to some standard multiple, it's the current of integration over W, right? And then you're intersecting that with a line. So that means you're counting the number of points of this line. And you take the sup over the lines. And then you're doing some kind of averaging. So you consider a bunch of parallel lines in some large ball, an arbitrarily large ball. Yeah, sorry. So there's another way to write this, which is a little nicer. Maybe I should do that. Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, so the idea of, okay, I can tell you even why very quickly. I'm going a little too quick. So The idea is something like this. You see, you can choose a sort of family of disks or orthogonal to this thing. And now what you'll do is apply the mean value property on these orthogonal disks. And that will basically allow you to compare the value at this point with the integral over the disk. So then you can easily prove that the evaluation is kind of bounded on a tubular neighborhood. And then the uniformly flat thing says that these tubular neighborhoods, you can kind of cover W with them without too much redundancy. Right? But of course, if you had a finite union of uniformly flat things, the same thing would happen. And in fact, that's the proof of the one-dimensional case. Is exactly how, that's why I said it wasn't very difficult. And the condition for higher dimensions is something like that. You know, if you take an arbitrary point in the ambient space, how many points of minimum distance to W are there? If that's bounded, that's essentially the condition for having a bounded restriction. Okay. So I was going to say that this, you can define something I call a total density tensor, which is you take the current of integration over W, and then you convolve that with the characteristic function of a ball of radius r, and then you normalize, you divide by its volume. So that's the, this is like some measure of the density that's independent of the weight, and what that thing up there says is that, it says that, that the curvature of this weight is greater than or equal to 1 plus epsilon times this total density tensor. So this is the same statement as right. So you evaluate this 1-1 form, which is the thing without the V's, you evaluate it on any given V, and if you evaluate the 1-1 form, that's the curvature of phi on that same V, their quotient has to be less than 1. So that's exactly what this says. Okay. Alright, but this is good because with something like this, you can allow weights that don't have strictly positive curvature. I completely forgot to mention that. So when I said PSH means that this dd bar phi is greater than or equal to 0. But we actually want, but in Sape's theorem, we need that the following is true, that not only is this positive, but it's greater than or equal to some constant times the Euclidean 1-1 form, and less than or equal to some other constant times the Euclidean 1-1 form. I'm sorry, I completely forgot to mention that. So for the Fock space, this is equal to the Euclidean area, but you need these bounds in order to do some of the estimates. So there's a question about why do you actually need them, or are they just technical assumption? And I'll address that partially soon. Okay. So today's now that half my time is up, I can get to the point of today's talk, the first point of today's talk. I want to consider two issues. first issue is singular W, and the second issue is the necessity of the flatness. The necessity of the density I can't say much about right now, but why would I want to consider singular W? I mean, it seems perfectly reasonable to just stop at smooth W. But if you have a point of view of an applied mathematician, you really don't even want to consider hypersurfaces. You want to consider points. And so how do you put points inside a hypersurface? So if you want to apply this theorem, you'd have to find a hypersurface which is smooth but not very dense. It doesn't wind around, doesn't come from functions with very essential singularities. And that would be very hard to find and also push your sequence into such a surface. You can't really perturb them or deform them very easily. But if you were allowed to just intersect a bunch of hyperplanes through the points, that could be much easier. And then you could reduce the dimension. You put your points inside some hyperplanes. And so, but the hyperplanes, if they meet, if they don't meet, they might become very, very dense if you choose them in the wrong direction. So you should allow them to meet, but then the hypersurface becomes singular. Still, it's not so singular. But we saw that this flatness condition at least plays some kind of role. So what should be the notion of flatness for singular hypersurfaces? What is a uniformly flat singular W? That's a good question. I'm going to tell you a definition, but it might just mean that the name uniformly flat is not a great one. Now, I'll leave that for you to decide. Okay, so maybe in this case it's better to draw a picture. It's not that hard to write down a definition, but the picture will be better. Okay, so here's what uniformly flat is going to mean. So suppose we have one of these singular hypersurfaces, W. There's a cusp there. This is like two smooth things intersecting locally, but it doesn't have to be. It could be connected somewhere far away. Okay, so uniformly flat means the following. So you want to say that there exists some epsilon 0 positive and A positive such that, okay, if you remove you take some neighborhood, so this is going to be radius A epsilon, okay, so this will be U sub A epsilon of the singular part of W. So in this picture, that's this point and this point. These are supposed to be the same size. So that's A epsilon. Okay, so this epsilon is between 0 and epsilon 0, but any such number. So you have this. You remove this, and you consider the rest of W, which is now just has smooth things, but they have boundary as well. Okay? You consider the rest of W, and now you consider orthogonal disks of radius epsilon, the rest of W. And what you should get is a tubular neighborhood on the complement. Okay? So these, any two of these disks should never meet. Okay, so if there are no singular points and you're not removing anything and you have the same definition as before, okay. But if there are singular points, then this introduces some other piece of information. So let's see. This can certainly happen. This A is some bound on basically the, if you think of this as the x-axis, this is a bound on the slope of this line relative to that x-axis. Okay? So that's what that A is. But on the other hand, this cusp is not allowed, because if you're a distance epsilon out of the cusp. I mean, this is pinching here. This distance here is going to be epsilon to a power if the disks aren't going to meet. So it wouldn't be linear in epsilon. Okay. So the intersections are, so this is allowed, but this is not allowed. And and there's even a bit of restriction on this kind of picture. These things are infinite, so you could imagine getting more and more of these lines that are intersecting transversely. But then if none of them are going to meet, this A has to be huge. So you want it, the A and the epsilon 0 must be bounded. Okay, so you also put a bound on the number of branches that you can have here. Okay, but that's good because when you intersect hyperplanes, you get these kinds of singularities. You don't get these, so that's nice. And the density, we keep the same, so this condition here stays the same. So I can state my first theorem. If phi satisfies C omega less than or greater than or equal to E D bar phi greater than or equal to epsilon 1 omega, comma, W is uniformly flat, possibly singular, and D plus C of W is less than 1, then this RW is surjective. Okay. Let me try to give you just a rough idea of how this kind of thing might be proved. So you consider your W, maybe it has some branches like this, and then you cover it by a bunch of balls of some sufficiently small size. So it'll be a covering by these balls. But they should have a uniform radius, all of them the same radius, epsilon. And the flatness condition will actually imply that you can cover it with balls that don't, not too many intersect any given, not too many contain any given point. Okay? So some bounded number contain any given point. And now you want to try to do, to extend the holomorphic function. So you have some f in this small h, and you want to try to extend it, and you consider its restriction to all of these balls. The W intersected with all of these balls. And now you would try to extend them one at a time. So I don't want to say how you do that. That's we did exactly that, at least for the smooth things. We did exactly that with Ortega and Schuster. But for the singular things, I should try to tell you at least how we do that. So maybe I could say one word about this. The point here is that you actually have some kind of normal directions along which you could try to extend your functions. Of course, you have a weight, but you have to deal with the fact that it's easy, using this upper bound of the curvature, it's easy to deal with the weight. You essentially can make it constant. But once you do that, you'll get a local extension. It's a little more technical than that, but not too bad. But what do you do in these singular points? Once you've done these, maybe just to finish my thought, once you've done these local extensions, you patch them together using the standard solution of the Mittag-Leffler problem that you learn in complex analysis classes. So the several complex variables version is the same. You can do it in a number of ways. So the main problem is to do the local extension. And on the smooth thing, that's already done. On the singular thing, it's more complicated. And so on the singular pieces, you must be careful. I'll explain in a minute why you have to be careful. So here's what you actually do. You do the following. Do this. So let's say you have one of these things. So locally, this really looks like some bounded number of smooth hypersurfaces that meet pairwise transversely. Okay. So maybe you could call each of them W1, W2, up to WK. And then you restrict F to each of these, you'll get some F1, F2, up to FK. Of course, you can extend each of these Fs, but you can't extend them all at once and then add them, because then things won't, you'll have trouble on the intersection. The values will double up. So you want to make sure that it vanishes on the intersection. Okay, so how do you do that? Well, you have to try to remove some consistent global piece from all of them. And you can do that. It's rather involved how you do that. So you move some global piece. So this G is defined on some particular ball, BJ, with appropriate estimates. Okay, and now you call this one F2 star, F1 star, and now you can extend each of these. But if you just extend these, you'll have a problem, because then the extension will have some value over here. And so if you extend F1 and F2, if F2 doesn't vanish on W1 when you add them, things will mess up for you. So you want to extend it in such a way that it vanishes on all the other pieces. Okay, so that starts to sound complicated, but amazingly, you can do this. So, here's a theorem that I proved for a completely different purpose before, and now I have to apologize. I'm going to use a completely different language of complex geometry. If you don't know it, I'm sorry. Okay, so so X is going to be a Stein-Kähler manifold. Kähler form is omega. Z in X is a smooth, doesn't have to be smooth, but for the purpose of this discussion, smooth hypersurface. H will be a holomorphic line bundle. And then it'll have a, with smooth metric. So you should, if you don't like line bundles, think that this isn't here. And then you really, the metric is just a weight. We'll call it e to the minus theta. So that's just a weight. Okay, but the weight is non-trivial, even if the line bundle isn't there. now you suppose Z is cut out by a section. So if you don't like the word section, just substitute holomorphic function. T such that there exists a weight e to the minus psi z for the line bundle associated to z. Z is a divisor, has a line bundle associated to it. If you don't like line bundles, this is just a weight. Omit the rest of these words. So such that the following two conditions are satisfied by this function that cuts out z. So the sup over all of x of t squared e to the minus psi z is 1. This is just a normalization. The important thing is that it's finite. After that, you can scale it. And 2, this is the density condition. There exists a positive epsilon such that dd bar square root of minus 1 dd bar theta plus the Ricci curvature of omega. So if x is cn, omega can be Euclidean metric. This is gone. Okay. This is greater than or equal to 1 plus epsilon times the curvature of this weight, square root of minus 1 dd bar psi sub z. And also, this should be greater than or equal to 0. Not just bigger than this, but if this happens to be negative, which it rarely is, then you add in this condition as well. So these are the hypotheses. And, bummer. Then, for all, little s, sections of ZH, if the line bundle H is trivial, this is just holomorphic functions on Z. So for all holomorphic functions on Z, satisfying the integral over Z of f squared e to the minus theta omega to the n minus 1. And then you have to divide by something here. Dt squared e to the minus psi sub z. If this is finite, so this is some kind of Hilbert space, but it's different from our previous Hilbert space. It has this additional weight. Okay, so for example, when w is singular, this is definitely there. And you're going to lose some of the holomorphic functions that you had when it wasn't there. But even if it's not singular, it might grow so rapidly that it puts constraints on functions. So for all finite things like this, there exists a capital F, a global section, so in other words, a holomorphic function on all of X, such that F restricted to Z is little f, and the integral over x, f squared e to the minus theta omega to the n, is less than or equal to some constant that depends only on n and epsilon. Epsilon is the density constant there, times this integral. Okay. Well, actually, this looks a lot like the theorem I stated with Ortega and Schuster, except the Hilbert spaces are a little different. And it's a little bit weaker. In the theorem with Ortega and Schuster, we had to assume this condition, which I also assumed for this theorem, up there for the phi. Okay? We had to assume that condition. Here, you're not assuming that. You're just assuming this non-negativity bound. Okay. But as I said, they're different Hilbert spaces, but it turns out, so this is, when I was giving a course on this stuff, I, just as an kind of exercise, I proved that, in fact, if W is smooth and uniformly flat, then this denominator here is bounded below by a positive constant. So actually, the condition for the curvature is extraneous. You don't need it. If you phrase the density condition like I did, if you don't try to use this thing as an area form and divide by it. So I asked around a little bit, and people seemed to think that there was no particular reason to introduce that condition other than it was technically needed. So I mean, I was really worried when I discovered this, but that seems okay. Okay, so how do I use this theorem in this case? Well, what you do is you take your theta. Well, the CZ doesn't matter too much here. That was more for the generalization of this theorem. But you take your theta to be not phi, but rather phi minus log of, so let me put here ti squared, the sum over I not equal to j. Okay, so what does that mean? That means that this e to the minus theta is e to the minus phi over the product for I not equal to j, ti squared. Okay, so now if you do L2 extension with respect to this weight, and you look at the thing you get, the thing you extended, you say, okay, so I know that I have an extension, a local extension, fj, product over I not equal to j. So I'm extending little fj. I know that this is finite. This is some smooth weight. Oh, sorry, this should be a phi. Okay. But then you have these absolute value squared of a holomorphic function. And you want to know, well, when can a function be L2 with respect to a weight like this? And this function is then forced to vanish on the zero set of the TI. You can do this calculation in one complex variable. It's the same calculation. You can't, if you have an absolute value squared of a holomorphic function here, the finiteness implies that this fj vanishes on the zero set of ti for each I not j. So you get what I said you needed. You get an extension of f1 star that vanishes on all the w2 up to wk. And now you add them together, you add back the G, and if you've done things correctly, you'll get your local L2 estimates. I have 2 minutes, so I will. Okay, so I should. Now I want to address necessity, which I thought I'd have more time for. So, necessity of flatness. So, necessity of the density, at the moment I can't say much, but it's very likely that something close to it is true, if not literally as is, it's true. You probably need the density to be strictly less than 1, but I'm really not sure. But the flatness is actually not necessary. So if you have, for example, so there are specific examples. So the first one would be in C2, for example, say z to the m plus w to the m equals 0. This has an isolated singularity. So you can find actually a polynomial that will make some function 0 to arbitrary order. Well, if you have a function that's L2, you want to make it vanish at the origin to high enough order so you can apply this theorem. Then you can get an extension, and now you at least you could try to prove that that has a finite L2 norm. Indeed it does. And you just, so you subtract away this polynomial, but for instance, if you're in the Fock space, all the polynomials are in the Fock space. So then you just add it back and you'll have an extension with an L2 estimate. So anyway, this is an example. But what about if you assume that the hypersurface is smooth? Maybe uniformly flatness is still true then. Well, no. And I'll just give you an indication why. So here's an example of something that's uniformly flat but singular. So this could be given, for example, by the equation ZW equals 0. Now suppose you considered ZW equals epsilon. That's very close to this guy. Okay. but the picture doesn't exactly look like that. It's actually connected because you're in the complex case. It's a copy of C minus the origin. Okay, so you see the problem with uniform flatness is you want to say if I have a holomorphic function on a hypersurface, then if I have an extension, the values shouldn't be allowed. The values of the extension, I mean, you shouldn't have the function you started with shouldn't have extremely different values over at these two points that are nearby in the ambient space. But in this picture, they're nearby in the ambient space and in the hypersurface. So you don't contradict this basic principle. Anyway, I'm going too fast for that. So let me just say, this is an example of something that is uniformly flat, but the extent of the flatness depends on epsilon. And now you can take something like x sine of x, or maybe z sine of z times y equals 1. This is a smooth hypersurface. If you divide by the z, which is happens to be non-zero on this hypersurface, you see that it looks more and more like this thing with epsilon going to zero near the multiples of pi, z equal to multiples of pi. So this picture here, it sort of looks like smoothings of something like this. But the slopes are getting tighter and tighter. I'm not drawing it very well. And that actually gives a counterexample to even the smooth uniform flatness. So sorry for going 10 seconds over time.